This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with Phyllis Bennis about the Trump administration's recent bombing of Syria.
The minute hand on the doomsday clock has moved closer to midnight.
We take a look at yet another case of a corrupt police officer in Chicago.
This detective, Ronaldo Guevara, put 51 people in prison for over 2,300 years, framing them up on a murder charge.
The landscape of police accountability across the nation by the Justice Department is about to change.
No more consent decrees, says Attorney General Jeff Sessions. He says they take away respect for the police officers.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Donald Trump made two important promises during the presidential campaign. He vowed to not get involved in the Syrian civil war, where jihadist groups have been trying to overthrow the government of Assad for 6 years. And the second promise he made during the campaign was to better relations with Russia, which is a supporter of Assad and a strategic ally of Syria. Syria borders Russia in the south and has a warm water Mediterranean port. Both of these promises were broken on April 4th, when President Trump illegally ordered the bombing by 54 Tomahawk missiles of the Shayat Air Base in eastern Syria. The missile strike violated the United Nations Charter, the Convention Against the Use of Chemical Warfare, and the United States law called the War Powers Act, not to mention Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution, which requires Congress to declare war. In support of his unilateral decision to bomb a sovereign nation with whom the United States is not at war, President Trump claimed that he was motivated by learning of the horrible death of several children in the farm village of Khan Shaykhun. The children died of an alleged poison gas attack, which Trump claimed was carried out by the Assad government, which denies the charge. Without an impartial objective investigation required by the Chemical Weapons Convention, without going to the United Nations Security Council, and without any evidence, President Trump claimed that sarin, a poison nerve gas, was used by the Assad government. Trump's former critics sprung to his defense. They included Hillary Clinton, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Republican leaders John McCain and Lindsey Graham, and the entire mass media, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, MSNBC, and CNN. Television reporter Brian Wilson used the word beautiful 3 times to describe the Tomahawk missile explosions. Why did Trump reverse his position of not getting involved in the Syrian civil war? Why did he all of a sudden take on Russia, to whom he had pledged better relations? Here to talk to us today is returning guest Phyllis Bennis of the Washington, D.C. Institute for Policy Studies. She is the author of many books on the Middle East.
Phyllis Bennis, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
Phyllis, many have suggested that in bombing Syria, Donald Trump's real targets were his domestic critics. His popularity was registered at 34%, the lowest rating in American history for a president just taking office. Was this a diversionary wag the dog moment? Or do you think Trump was sincere when he said his opposition to anti-Assad military action was reversed when he saw photos of children struggling to breathe after the chemical attack?
I would say no and no. I don't think that it was because he had some momentary humanitarian crisis. If he did, he might have considered that those same children were the ones who he was perfectly prepared to say, I will slam the door in their faces and not allow them in, when they are fleeing the same kind of terror and violence in Syria as elsewhere in his Muslim ban. But I don't think I would say it's purely a diversionary effort. There's certainly an aspect of that, the low approval ratings, this president's urgent, constant need to prove that he's popular, and as is so often tragically the case in this country, going to war gets you a lot of cheers from people who were jeering you just before that. So that's certainly a factor. But I think this is also a very dangerous, very real move to assert militarism as evidence of strength and toughness, if you will. I wish that I thought it was purely a political act, just as a diversion, but I'm afraid it might be more than that. I think the fact that it was accompanied by sending warships to North Korea, an incredibly dangerously provocative move, today and yesterday escalating the rhetoric against Russia, means that this is not just a diversion. This is a, I don't think it's a strategy, but I think it's a very dangerous set of moves that will have very uncertain consequences in the world.
And we want to talk a bit more about that, but I think first, can you explain to our listeners why this attack on Syria was illegal?
Sure. I think what we're seeing in Syria was an attack that is a violation both of domestic and international law. The domestic law is very clear. In the Constitution says that only Congress has the right to declare war. Now, that's something that, as we know, has been taken more often as something to be ignored than something to be enforced. But nonetheless, it is there. And we know the last time Congress actually declared war was back in World War II. All the wars since then, from the Korean War, the Vietnamese War, all of those wars, were in fact illegal. They were not declared by the Congress. But we also have to look more specifically at the War Powers Act, which is cited a lot by Congress, and to see, well, does that allow a even short-term action by the president? And what gets ignored a lot of times, because the War Powers Act includes stuff about notifying Congress within 48 hours after a strike, which Trump did do 6 hours ahead of the deadline. He sent a notification to Congress. But what that ignores is the earlier part of the War Powers Resolution that still limits incredibly tightly when the president can use force at all, when he can introduce the U.S. military into hostilities. There's only three situations that allow that, according to the text of the War Powers Act. First, if Congress declares war. That hasn't happened. Second, quote, a national emergency created by an attack on the United States, its territories, its possessions, or its armed forces. Okay, that hasn't happened either. Nobody attacked the U.S. in Syria. And the third, if there's a specific authorization from Congress. That didn't exist here. And interestingly, the Trump administration didn't even try to claim, as the Obama administration did and as the Bush administration did before that, that the early 2001 authorization for the use of force against Afghanistan to go after the Taliban for 9/11, it was only to go after Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, that authorization has been stretched and pulled and applied to things it had no bearing on, but nonetheless, that was the claim. And as is always true in law, you guys know this better than most, any law is only worth somebody holding it up and trying to enforce it. A law on the books that nobody tries to enforce doesn't mean anything. So if Congress doesn't use these restrictions, they don't really mean anything. But it clearly was illegal under the U.S. domestic law. Under international law, the U.N. Charter is the supreme law of the world in determining issues of peace and security. And the Charter, you know, the Charter is pretty vague about a lot of stuff. There's stuff in there that you can read it 15 different ways. But on the question of when is a military act legal, it's really very clear. There's only two times when a military action is legal, according to the U.N. Charter. Number one, if the Security Council approves. Clearly that didn't happen. Number two, if it's a case of immediate self-defense, a country has been attacked. Well, our country was not attacked, and there was no legal justification in international law for this military strike. The fact that other strikes had already gone on, also in violation, doesn't change any of that. So both in international law and in domestic law, the U.S. strike was illegal.
Phyllis, let's talk about what actually happened. What do we know and what do we not know about the attack? The Syrian President Assad denies responsibility. He said that his jets targeted an arms depot where chemicals were stockpiled by the Islamic State and the al-Nusra Front militia. The Russian Ministry of Defense has confirmed that account. But U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says that he has, quote, these are his words, no doubt that Assad did a chemical weapons attack. What do you think happened?
What I think happened doesn't really matter. I think it's probably more likely the government of Syria than the opposition because of who had access to planes. But I don't know that. I don't know for sure it was planes that delivered these terrible weapons. And we certainly don't know at this point who carried it out. Now, the story from the Syrian government that was backed up by the Russian government may well be true. There's some aspects of it that don't quite add up, one of them being that sarin, as a weaponized sarin gas, is not stored by itself. It's stored in two parts and is only mixed together because it's very volatile at that point when it's actually loaded into a munition. So if it was stored there, it would be stored in two components, two chemical components, which, if they were hit by a bomb, would not have created sarin gas in that context. Now, I'm no expert on this stuff. This is what I'm hearing from experts from the international core of experts around the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons. On the other hand, the U.S. claim so far is groundless. Now, what we've seen, the U.S. government declassified some intelligence information that they say proves that it was carried out by the regime. That hasn't been made public, although it's been declassified. The reports of it seem to indicate that it's basically some satellite information that they say proves that a Russian-made, Syrian-piloted plane took off from a particular base and dropped chemical weapons. Now, it's not clear to me how they can prove any of that other than that a plane took off. I don't think that we know that yet. But the bottom line is we can't trust what the U.S. intelligence reports say, and we certainly can't trust how this administration cherry-picks from what may be a wide range of contradictory intelligence reports to claim this. We simply cannot, should not, must not rely on the U.S. claims of what happened. So I think until there is an independent international investigation of what happened, there's no basis to make a judgment. What's even more important, Michael, is that this is one of those classic even-if cases. Even if we knew somehow after an international report from the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons or the United Nations, if we knew from some credible force that it was whoever, that it was one of the armed militias that was operating there, or we knew that it was the Syrian government, or that we knew it was the U.S., no matter who did it, even if we knew, it would not give the United States the right to use military force against the Syrian government or against anyone else in that context. The fact that it would be, and it is, a separate violation of international law to use chemical weapons, horrific weapons, and whoever used it should be held accountable. Accountability does not mean a unilateral strike, an illegal unilateral strike by the United States against a town in Syria. That's not legal, even if we knew. Since we don't know, it's doubly illegal.
Phyllis, two of the groups supporting Trump's attack are the neocons and the humanitarian interventionists. The neocons supported the 2003 attack on Iraq, falsely claiming that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. The humanitarian interventionists supported Obama's attack on Libya, where President Gaddafi was captured and bayoneted to death and his government overthrown. Can you talk to us about the neocons and the humanitarian interventionists?
You know, Heidi, these are two of, unfortunately, too many political factions and groups in this country that are supporting all of these wars. The neocons have this broad view of transforming the world to look like the United States. So while they made the claims in the Iraq context about weapons of mass destruction as a way of gaining public support for that war, their goal had nothing to do with weapons. Whether some of them believed there were weapons or not isn't really the point. Their political goal which had been created long before even the allegations of Saddam Hussein's government having weapons of mass destruction emerged. Their goals were the transformation of a number of countries in the Middle East. Iraq at the top of the list, Iran on the list. Syria at one time was on the list, although at other times the Syrian regime under first Bashar al-Assad's father, Hafez al-Assad, and then under Bashar al-Assad, had collaborated directly with the United States. So Syria was a different matter. But their goal was to, from the beginning, overthrow the regime, change the regime, turn those countries into something entirely different than what they were. And the wars were designed very explicitly to do just that. In this context, they see the opportunity for overthrowing the government in Syria in that same context. We're going to make Syria into a new kind of country. It'll be democratic. It'll be wealthy. It'll be great. Everybody will get along. And it's like, yeah, how's that going for you in Libya? How's that going for you in Iraq? How's that going for you in Somalia, in all of these countries where the goal has been regime change? They haven't changed. Some of them are still claiming that the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq was a good thing and that everybody in Iraq is better off these days just because Saddam Hussein is dead. You know, this is it's insanity. Now, on the other group that you mentioned, the humanitarian interventionist types, as you say, led by Hillary Clinton, of course, in 2011 when she was then the Secretary of State, supposedly the diplomat in chief for the United States, she acted as the war in chief, calling for direct military engagement in Libya, knowing full well and laughing when it happened that the result of that military intervention and the intention of it was indeed regime change in Libya, as opposed to, ironically enough, then Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who said we should not be sending any kind of armed engagement into Libya. It would be an act of war, that a so-called no-fly zone means going to war with Libya. He was very clear about it. It was the negotiator-in-chief who should have been supporting diplomacy, instead was supporting war, and her faction won out. It's many of the same analysis that basically says for these folks, any human rights violation that goes on around the world requires a military response, and it should always be done by the United States because we stand for justice. Now, the question then becomes, how many false claims are part of that sentence? The United States does not stand for justice in any of these wars. It has never stood for justice. Human rights violations, you know, these kinds of humanitarian crises, which are all too real and all too horrific, do not require military responses. They require economic and political and diplomatic and humanitarian and a whole host of other responses, not including the military. That's what doesn't get talked about. When we hear the very real calls from people, from ordinary people, not from Donald Trump who makes it up on the fly, the real calls to say, this is horrific, we need to do something, that's a very legitimate kind of position for people to have. And it's legitimate for those of us who live in the wealthiest and most powerful country in the history of humanity to say we have a special obligation to do something. The problem is when do something becomes do something military. There's plenty of things that we have an obligation to do. None of them involve the military, but unfortunately, those military actions are the only ones that get any attention.
We've been talking with Phyllis Menes from the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis, what lessons do you draw from Trump's reversals and the broad establishment support that he's garnered?
Well, I think the lesson first is an old lesson, and that is that any president that's faced with declining poll numbers, worried about not getting support, if they send troops into action, send bombers into action, send drones into action, and kill a few people across the world, they're going to see a jump in their poll numbers. That's the first lesson. That's not new and different. That's old school, and Trump is just using it like so many presidents before him. What's more dangerous, I think, is that we do have an administration without a strategy, without a clear either ideological or political framework for their foreign policy work. There is no coherence here. And while the framework of earlier administrations, whether it was, you know, during the Cold War, during the so-called global war on terror, the idea that there was some consistency in how foreign policy was carried out was usually pretty bad foreign policy. At least we knew how to be able to challenge it, how to fight against it. Right now, things are so chaotic. The centers of power inside the administration are so divided. The dangers of the kind of lashing out, almost childish approaches that the Trump administration has carried out, and then never pulling back, but always pushing forward so that once you carry out something like this bombing in Syria, claiming, well, it's just a one-off. This was just to send a message. You know, we kill people and break things and destroy cities to send a political message. But then we expect everybody else to say, oh, it's just a message. We don't have to respond. At the moment, frankly, we've been lucky because both Russia and Iran are behaving like the adults in the room, unlike our administration. How long that's going to continue is anybody's guess. Iran is about to go into an election season. There's going to be a great deal of rhetorical escalations in fulminations against the United States, et cetera. We don't know where that's going to go. The Russian president and the prime minister face their own political challenges where they have to maintain a certain positioning. And if they decide that it's politically too risky for them to continue to simply not respond militarily to this military action, we could see a very rapid and incredibly dangerous escalation of direct military conflict between the United States and Russia. The fact that the administration at that same moment sent warships to North Korea, a country with a kind of similarly unstable and unpredictable leader and unpredictable level of responses, in a very provocative move, means that there's absolutely no coherent strategic approaches to this. The U.S. attack in Syria, in Idlib province, was clearly not tied to some broader strategy. And I think that's a very, very dangerous reality.
Before we let you go, I wanted to ask you if you could tell our listeners how they can keep abreast with the work of the Institute for Policy Studies and your own writings.
Sure. The Institute's website is ips-dc.org. And once you're on it, if you go to either my name or the New Internationalism Project, you'll get all my recent stuff.
Phyllis, thanks so much. As always, a pleasure.
Thank you, Phyllis.
Great to be with you both.
Yeah, you take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Years ago, the great comedian Lenny Bruce used a crack that Chicago is so corrupt it's thrilling. It has become known as the false conviction capital of the USA. Today, retired Chicago detective Reynaldo Guevara is accused of framing at least 51 people for murder, most of them from Humboldt Park in Chicago, a working-class, predominantly Puerto Rican neighborhood. He was on the force from the 1980s through the early 2000s. Guevara's alleged misconduct sent 48 men and one woman to be sentenced to a total of 2,300 years in prison. Three were acquitted, five received life sentences, three were sentenced to death, but spared when in 2003 Governor George Ryan, disturbed by a rash of wrongful convictions, commuted all of the death sentences to life in prison or less. Two men died behind bars. The initial work in uncovering Guevara's misconduct fell by default to a group of women, mostly working-class mothers, aunts, and sisters, who, with limited English and limited familiarity with the American law, began working to uncover the frame-ups of their loved ones. As investigative reporter Melissa Segura has written in BuzzFeed, armed with nothing more than dining room tables full of transcripts, police reports, and post-it notes marking the cracks in the cases against their loved ones, together they identified patterns running through Guevara's cases. They achieved some victories. They gave information to the civil rights firm of Lovey & Lovey in Chicago, a firm which helped free Juan Johnson, who later went on to receive a record $21 million in a judgment against the city of Chicago because of Guevara's misconduct. So far, 6 men have had their convictions overturned and 12 others have been released. 29 who say they were framed remain in prison. We speak today with two of the attorneys in Chicago at the Lovey & Lovey Law Firm, which is litigating these cases. Attorney Tara Thompson, in addition to her work with the Lovey & Lovey firm, is a clinical teacher at the Exoneration Project, a partnership with Lovey & Lovey and the University of Chicago Law School. Through the Exoneration Project, she has successfully represented numerous clients who have been freed from prison for crimes they did not commit. We speak as well with Lovey & Lovey attorney Anand Swaminathan, whose practice focuses on wrongful convictions, medical care in prisons, and the representation of corporate and public employee whistleblowers. He is litigating one of the constitutional civil rights cases arising from the Guevara frame-ups, including exploring the policies and practices that allowed Guevara's pattern of police misconduct to persist.
Tara and Anand, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having us.
Tara, tell us about Rinaldo Guevara. How did he operate?
Rinaldo Guevara was a detective who worked primarily in the Humboldt Park neighborhood of Chicago, which is primarily a Latino neighborhood. And he was a detective who primarily investigated crimes that he believed involved gang activity. And he had two shortcuts that he would use to solve cases when either he didn't want to do the work to solve those or when they were just difficult. One thing he would do is coerce confessions from people by physically abusing them to get them to falsely confess. And that, unfortunately, is a method that we are familiar with in Chicago from other cases, including the cases involving John Burge. The other thing he would do was a little more complicated, which is he would go to somebody that he knew either had gang connections or was in some way vulnerable to the police, and he would say, I need you to be an eyewitness in this case, and if you don't identify the following person or people as the people that you saw do this crime, I'm going to go to somebody else and do the same thing to them, only I'm going to be showing them your picture. And he would get people to falsely identify other people as being people who committed crimes or get people to become eyewitnesses to things they had never even witnessed. And that's a pattern that we've seen with Detective Guevara in, you know, involving at least 51 people probably over the decades that he worked as a detective before he retired in 2005.
And Tara, what role did the female relatives of the framed up men play in bringing these cases forward?
Detective Guevara's cases are a really good example of how community involvement and community pressure can make a difference in uncovering misconduct. In the late 1990s, there was a group of women who were relatives and friends of primarily the men who had been wrongfully convicted by Detective Guevara, and they formed a committee called Comité Exigimos Justicia, or We Demand Justice. And that group, on their own, identified victims of Detective Guevara. They together organized and made, you know, databases of people who had been abused or people who had been falsely identified by Detective Guevara. They held press conferences. They held community meetings. And they really together said, we refuse to let this issue go away. We refuse to be silenced. We refuse to be ignored. And they really forced, I think, everyone in Chicago to continue to take a look at these issues and to confront Detective Guevara's misconduct. And without those women, without the community doing that, this is an issue that I'm sure people in power here in Chicago would have loved to let die.
The other thing that was striking when you learn about the work that those women did is what you recognize is they were doing the work that internal investigators should have been doing all along. I mean, the process of going through and looking at all the various cases, all the various allegations and complaints, seeing the patterns and bringing them to light, that was the work that internal investigators should have been doing when they had decades of opportunities to see the patterns in Guevara's conduct.
You know, it's just extraordinary for us to contemplate how somebody could get away with this kind of misconduct for like almost 30 years. And there must have been a lot of blind eyes turned to it. Can you talk about how he got away with this and who turned the blind eye?
Well, when you have a scenario like this, a lot of people have to look the other way for this to be able to go forward in the ways that it did for as long as it did and as damaging as it was. And so, you know, ultimately, when someone like Guevara does the kind of things that Tara has described, that means that, you know, partners who were working with him were looking the other way. His supervisors were looking the other way. Ultimately, line prosecutors who are involved in prosecuting all of the individuals one by one who come forward, they're looking the other way because those line prosecutors are seeing the same witnesses come forward, the same patterns, the same one by one anonymous phone calls keep coming in. People keep appearing in these windows all of a sudden, just happen to be looking out the window at the right moment in time. They see these patterns too, and they look the other way because they're getting prosecutions. You know, ultimately, one of the things that is striking here is there was a federal prosecution into another rogue officer, a guy named Majinowski, who was a notorious officer who was running a drug ring out of the Chicago Police Department. And he was ultimately prosecuted by the federal prosecutors and is serving a life sentence now. But during the course of the investigation into Majinowski in 2001, the FBI did an interview with a witness who explained Ray Guevara's pattern of conduct. And that witness told federal prosecutors in 2001, with a Chicago police sergeant present at the interview, that Guevara's policy was to catch a person with drugs or guns, let them buy their way out of trouble. He was said to have accepted bribes to change positive or negative identifications during lineups for murder cases. These are things that this witness told the federal prosecutors in 2001. Nothing was done. These grandmothers came forward and met with federal prosecutors in 2003. In the wake of this witness giving this information about Guevara, and they told all about the pattern of conduct they were seeing with Guevara, nothing was done. So a lot of people have to look the other way for something like this to persist as long as it did.
Can you think of any examples of how this type of situation should be handled? There's, a case similar in Brooklyn, New York.
We have to be willing to accept that these things happened and be willing to look and to investigate in the past. And that's one of the issues that I think has been somewhat handled in Brooklyn, where you've seen a DA, Ken Thompson, who was willing to say, I think we might have issues here and we're willing to investigate. If a department, a state's attorney's office, a prosecutor, a city government is not even willing to look at what happened, to investigate it, then these crimes are going to continue to go uncovered. And that's an issue that, unfortunately, with Guevara, we've seen in Chicago as well, that the city of Chicago did commission a report, the Lasser report from a law firm, where a law firm looked into these issues to some extent. They made some recommendations to the city, and the city and the state's attorney's office and other people here in Chicago really took no action so far in response to that report. And so if there can't be investigation, if you can't look at the information you have and say, we need to look into this further, we need to take action, then nothing is going to change.
Now that we've got a new Attorney General, Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions, telling us that he's going to roll back these consent decrees with various police departments across the country, do you think that'll do much damage, and how so?
One of the things in Chicago is this is just awful timing for us. I mean, this is a city where finally you have the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice came forward with a series of findings. And those findings were quite thorough. I mean, they went and spent time meeting with all kinds of folks, not only lawyers in the civil rights community, lawyers in the criminal defense community, but they spent a lot of time doing what they should have been doing, which is out in the streets talking to community members. And they learned a lot about what was happening in Chicago, and they issued a series of findings. Those findings would typically result in a consent decree. That may not happen now and likely isn't going to happen now under the new Attorney General. And one of the things they really highlighted was the complete lack of an internal investigation and disciplinary process. And that is obviously one of the things that allows someone like Guevara to do the things that he did. So that's extremely concerning, because an opportunity now to have some meaningful reform of the internal investigation process, to do something, to have some early intervention to prevent all these people from being wrongfully convicted, and, they should be caught much earlier on. That chance may go away. And so that's very concerning for those of us here in Chicago. But the other thing I wanted to mention about Jeff Sessions and his administration, this is something Tara can really pick up on. There was a New York Times recently reported that he is rolling back, essentially defunding and scrapping efforts that took place within Department of Justice to deal with problems in forensic science. So there have been, in the last 5 to 10 years, a lot of revisiting what is going on in the field of forensic science, and things that are thought to be understood, accepted types of science, it turns out are actually very unreliable, and they are unreliable methods that have resulted in many, many, many people being convicted of crimes. And so it raises some real questions, both looking backward and going forward, about what are proper and reliable techniques for assessing and making identifications of people as part of investigations. And what he has basically said is, a blue ribbon panel put out all these recommendations about areas of forensic science that are problematic, and he's saying, I'm scrapping that process. And that's, I think Tara can really talk about some specific ways that that's problematic.
Tara, what are some of the issues related to scientific investigation or forensics?
The National Forensic Science Commission that Anand was discussing just a minute ago was an organization that was intended to bring together law enforcement, scientific experts, people in the innocence movement, prosecutors, bring everyone together to talk about how you effectively solve these cases. Because this goes, I think, back to the issues we see in Guevara. It's shortcuts. It's not really caring about the truth, not looking for actual answers in these cases, but trying to, you know, take steps to quote-unquote close these cases that don't really go to the truth. And what the Forensic Science Commission was trying to do was develop methods of ensuring that science that's being used in these cases is right. And it's very concerning for me and for other people in the post-conviction community, people that care about getting the right answer in these cases, regardless of how much time has passed, to see a lack of interest in making sure that the science that's being used is accurate and correct and that we can rely on the scientific methods that are being used in court. One of the criticisms that I read from the DOJ about the new DOJ, about that commission, is that it's, I think the word someone used was that it's become a think tank. Well, it's very concerning to hear this Justice Department say that they don't actually want to think about these issues. They don't want to bring together experts to discuss them. And if that's the Department of Justice that we have looking at these issues in that way now, we should all be very concerned about that.
On a related note, I'm curious about local media coverage in Chicago. Are there investigative reporters that have, you know, taken this story and run with it?
There has been local media interest in these issues, and there was actually an investigative reporter from BuzzFeed, the national news organization, Melissa Segura, who spent over a year in-depth investigating and looking at the pattern of misconduct by Detective Guevara, who just published an extensive online piece on BuzzFeed about Detective Guevara, about his victims, about the comité, and has really done some great work in exposing these issues. And we hope that her work, the work of other local journalists here in Chicago, will prompt, you know, other journalists to take a closer look at these issues, because there's more to this story that I think has yet to be uncovered.
Yeah, Tara, and we'll link to that article, which Heidi and I have both read. I wanted to ask you about the litigation that the two of you are currently involved in. Tell us a little bit about those cases and what you hope to accomplish.
Sure. So, you know, we have some cases that are in active discovery, and so we have some limitations on what we'll be able to say about those specific cases. But one of the things we're trying to do is make sure that we are using these cases to try to understand the full scope of what the problem is, to understand who are all the people who have been affected by Guevara's course of conduct, and what has allowed this to happen. So one of the things we are exploring is these issues of policies and practices that allow someone like Guevara to be able to do the things he did and to do it as long as he did. So we are doing discovery into not just Guevara's conduct, but all of the policies and practices that allowed Guevara to do this, and how internal investigation processes failed, what incentives were set up within the police department to, rather than disincentivize misconduct, actually incentivize misconduct to allow them to close cases.
Can you give us some examples of this?
Just using Guevara as an example, we have learned a lot about the complaints against him. One thing we've learned is, I think, you know, some of this is now public. There were 27 complaints lodged against Guevara over the years, just 15 complaints between 1982 and 2005. He was someone who was the subject of five times as many complaints as the average officer. very little was done to address his conduct. He was someone who ultimately received promotions in the wake of these complaints, not discipline. So these are the kinds of things that you see happen when you look at it. You look at the internal investigation process. It's not just that they didn't reach meaningful conclusions that would result in discipline. They didn't identify the patterns. It's that they don't even go back and do the work that the grandmothers did. They don't do the work and find the pattern. Look at the other complaints that were made against him. Why am I seeing different people who don't know each other make the same complaints? They don't go back and even question Officer Guevara about his conduct. So when you start to look at the internal investigation process, what you start to learn is this is a process that can never succeed.
Tara, can you tell us something about your work with the University of Chicago and what you folks are involved in terms of litigation?
Our project, the Exoneration Project, is a post-conviction project where we work with law students in investigating and litigating cases like those of Guevara victims, people who have been wrongfully convicted. And we do currently have several cases where we're pursuing post-conviction relief in the courts in Chicago for people who are victims of Detective Guevara.
How can people learn more about the work that you folks are doing?
People can find us on our website, which is just exonerationproject.org. We're also somewhat active on Facebook and on Twitter, and we regularly publish links to stories about Detective Guevara, about some of our clients, and that's a good way to learn more about these issues.
Great. Well, this seems to Heidi and me to be something that's going to be an ongoing story, just like Detective Burge, who tortured over 100 people and got false confessions. That was a real saga. So we're going to be checking back with you two, and we're so grateful for you being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for your fine work.
Thanks for having us. We appreciate you caring about these issues and trying to uncover the truth here.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
During the Obama administration, the Justice Department sought to reform police practices considered discriminatory by using a statutory tool little known by the public. So-called consent decrees were established after the Los Angeles Rodney King riots. They allow the department's Civil Rights Division to sue local police forces that have been found to have what is called a pattern and practice of using excessive force or violating individuals' rights. The Department of Justice launches an investigation into a police department's operations, frequently after a high-profile incident, such as the 2014 shootings of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Laquan McDonald in Chicago, Illinois. If the feds find that the departments operate with an ongoing pattern of abuse, they sue, in essence forcing the law enforcement groups to settle the cases and undergo a change to their culture, to a degree deemed sufficient by the court and the Department of Justice. Some of the more recent agreements, like those in Baltimore and Ferguson, are better known to the public, but others are not, and many have not yet seen a resolution. Out of 19 investigations carried out since 2010, for example, 6 are still considered ongoing. In 2008, Jeff Sessions said that, quote, one of the most dangerous and rarely discussed exercises of raw power is the issuance of expansive court decrees. Consent decrees have a profound effect on our legal system as they constitute an end run around the democratic process. The new Attorney General has threatened to do away with consent decrees. Joining us today to talk about consent decrees and, in general, policing in the United States is Attorney Carl Massinio. Carl is co-founder of the D.C.-based Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, a public interest legal organization that has been at the forefront in some of this country's leading police misconduct litigation. Welcome back, Carl Massinio, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me back.
Carl, much of Eric Holder's years were spent rebuilding the Civil Rights Division, repeatedly calling it the federal agency's crown jewel. Jeff Sessions has long been a critic of Holder's policies and is threatening to undo consent decrees. What do you think the impact of this will be in the area of policing in this country?
I think it's going to be devastating for civil rights, devastating for people who live with the threat of oppression from the police, of excessive use of force, people who are in African-American communities that find themselves targeted disproportionately by police policies, that find themselves under circumstances where police are using force, including murder, including lethal force, shooting to kill, at extraordinary rates that are both disproportionate racially and as well unjustified by any circumstances. I think that Jeff Sessions has really declared war on civil rights.
Now, in a minute, we're going to ask you about some of the cases that the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund has handled over the years. But in response to what you've just said, what recourse do victims of police misconduct have if consent decrees are going to be abolished, especially in certain cities such as Chicago, Baltimore, Ferguson?
Well, the recourse that people will have is twofold. One is through litigation, through the court system, by having civil rights attorneys bring civil rights lawsuits, false arrest lawsuits, wrongful death lawsuits, pattern and practice lawsuits alleging and evidencing unconstitutional courses of conduct by municipalities and police departments. That's one way of approaching it. The other approach is street action, community activism, because both historically, both these tools historically have played a role in pushing back against unconstitutional police practices, regardless of the posture of the Department of Justice.
Talk to us about some of the cases that the Partnership for Civil Justice has handled, and how are you able to make some progress on this?
Well, for example, here in Washington, D.C., there was a long-standing pattern and practice of unconstitutional conduct, use of excessive force, in particular against persons engaged in free speech activities, which was of great significance because here in the nation's capital, so many people come to engage in lawful, peaceful protest activities. What they encountered when they came here were sweeping mass arrests, often acts of very excessive use of force that was completely unjustified against persons who were peacefully protesting. What occurred here in Washington, D.C. as a consequence of our litigation and also as a consequence of activism here is that the district introduced omnibus reform legislation. Components of that of the reform came through that legislation, and components of reform came through our litigation, through imposing equitable relief, rules that were negotiated in resolution of our constitutional rights lawsuits. As a consequence of that, there has been a substantial bulwark put in place against the mass arrests that we saw so frequently and the beatings that we saw so frequently against protesters here in Washington, D.C.
Carl, can you talk a bit about some of the recent consent agreements or consent decrees? I know Baltimore and Ferguson are two. What do you think is going to happen there?
I wanted to add, Carl, that Kevin Davis, the police chief in Baltimore, said if they take away the consent decree, he said, quote, it's a punch in the gut.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think that it's important to look at the Baltimore consent decree as a really clear example of how out of line Jeff Sessions actually is, including being out of sync with what law enforcement wants. The consent decree here in Baltimore is really a long time coming, and what the Department of Justice found in its extensive investigation, which was sparked by the death of Freddie Gray in police custody while he was being transported in a police van, what the DOJ investigation found was a pattern and practice of excessive force, disproportionate stops and frisks, use of force against African Americans, completely unjustified. What they described is really two Baltimores, the white, affluent Baltimore, and then the rest of Baltimore that was disproportionately affected by these unconstitutional police tactics. But what's important about Baltimore is that there was recognition in Baltimore that the system was damaged, that it was broken, that reforms were necessary. The mayor of Baltimore, the police chief in Baltimore, all support the consent decree. The consent decree imposes oversight. It imposes new training, best practices, includes mandatory cameras in police transport vans, and an emphasis on de-escalation tactics to avoid the lethal uses of force that were documented. Now, Jeff Sessions comes from above on high and sought to overturn that consent decree that was supported by everyone involved. And fortunately, His efforts were rejected by a federal district court judge just this month, who found that time was of the essence, that there could be no delay, and that the terms of this detailed and extensive consent decree were essential for the safety and welfare of the people of Baltimore.
But Sessions says that this consent decree in Baltimore, he says, quote, undermines the respect for police officers. Can you comment on that?
Well, the consent decree was supported by law enforcement, so there's no question that it is not a vehicle of disrespect, but the problems that it remedies were unconstitutional and violent policing. This is not about respect or disrespect. It is about protecting people from an out-of-control police force. In Baltimore, the Baltimore Police Department made about 44% of its stops in just two predominantly African-American districts that contained only about 11% of the population. So that what you have, as occurred in neighborhoods, you know, with that had stop and frisk in New York City also, you had African-American persons who were stopped 10, 20, and some more than 30 times just during a five-year period of study. And what's critical is that the Baltimore Police Department stops were lawless. Only 3% of the pedestrian stops actually resulted in citations or arrests. And, of course, when we move on and take a look at other components, use of force, searching. For example, African Americans were searched far more frequently than whites. And what's curious and interesting and revealing about this is that when searched, contraband was actually found two times as frequently on white civilians who were subject to police search. So this is not being driven by fact. It's not being driven by law enforcement needs. It's being driven by discrimination and excessive authority of the police department.
Carl, a procedural question. Does Sessions actually have the authority to undo existing consent decrees? Don't the district courts oversee those?
Well, that is correct. With respect to the mechanics of a consent decree is that the parties are the Department of Justice, the federal government that comes in when local law enforcement has failed to be accountable to such a degree that there is just a situation that is explosive on the ground, and the agreement of local law enforcement. The decree is entered into on paper and then subject it needs to be approved by a federal court, by a federal judge. Once it's approved by a judge, it becomes enforceable. It is the law. It can't be undone without court approval. Now, this is significant when we take a look at the situation in Chicago, where the Department of Justice issued a scathing report against the Chicago Police Department, which historically has been a very violent and out-of-control police department. That is in a different posture than the Baltimore consent decree or the consent decrees that were negotiated with 13 other jurisdictions. With respect to Chicago, there is a highly detailed document laying out the pattern and practice of unconstitutional policing, but that has not been rolled into a detailed consent decree that's approved by a judge. That document, that finding, is really in jeopardy now. And the people who are living in Chicago are likely not going to get benefit of the best practices in police, new technology, the imposition of body cameras, the potential creation of an independent civilian review board, all of those things that are actually quite ordinary and normal responses to these things are not going to be available to them because Sessions is seeking to prevent a court from adopting it.
I'm trying to make a sense of the fact that, given what you've just said, and that a lot of these reforms are actually welcomed by police departments, and the fact that I understand that Department of Justice investigations begin by reaching out to all officers of varying ranks and levels of authority and to police unions, I'm trying to make sense of Sessions' animosity for this. Do you think it reflects pressure from police unions or just wanting to have the appearance of a closer relationship with law enforcement, even though law enforcement welcomes some of these decrees?
Well, this reflects a political decision by the Trump administration that is being executed by Jeff Sessions, which is to roll back civil rights, to roll back the rule reforms that are put in place after their findings of patterns and practices of unconstitutional and violent police practices. This is a political call coming from the top by Trump, and it's going to affect everyone in all of these communities. And again, some fraternal orders of police, some police unions are quite reactionary. The one in Chicago is notoriously reactionary. But in many cases, for example, in Baltimore, law enforcement wholeheartedly supports the reforms because, in their view, the concept of constitutional policing in a civil society.
The fraternal order of police goes back over 100 years. They've got 300,000 members. It's a political outfit as well as a fraternal order. And the last election cycle, they supported Trump.
That's correct. And there is a reactionary view that imposing constitutional restraints on police somehow is disrespectful of police or hurts their morale. The fact is police have an obligation to adhere to these basic constitutional norms, and what we are talking about are constitutional norms that are being applied in the most egregious of circumstances. I mean, the situation with Chicago documents how the Chicago Police Department engage in pursuits of people who are unarmed on foot and end up discharging their weapons at them. I mean, there is no basis for this, and it doesn't happen once. It doesn't happen twice. It's not isolated acts of errant police officers, but it accumulates to such a degree that it's clearly a pattern and practice that really cries out for a systemic response. Sessions rejects that.
And that request for systemic reform is going to be all the more important with Sessions in office.
That's absolutely correct. And as I said before, what we were talking about is really a twofold approach. There needs to be litigation because litigation brings the authority of the judicial system to be imposed on municipalities and police departments that are out of control. But at the same time, the community activism is essential. It is part of the social justice movement that creates the political force that also imposes accountability on these police departments.
Carl, where can our listeners go to learn more about the partnership's work?
They can come to our website at www.justiceonline.org.
Carl Massineo, it's always a pleasure to have you on, and we hope to have you keep us up to date over the next few years about developments coming out of our Capitol.
I would be happy to, and it's always a pleasure to be with both of you.
Thanks so much, Carl. You take it easy.
Take care.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.